Welcome to the Chamber of Musical Curiosities, a podcast exploring the world in and around Music Aviva Australia.
Hello, welcome to the podcast. I'm here with my old friend, Paul McDermott, whom I first met in 1981. Paul, you can choose whether to disclose the nature of our first meeting, although I can assure everyone that it was for a very elevated artistic project.
We met, I was hornswoggled by Diane Judge to be a singer in a musical. This was a year after I left school because word had spread through the ecumenical and charismatic renewal movement in Canberra that I had a gorgeous voice. And so Diana Judge asked me to come to, was it Braddon Girls High?
No, certainly not. We didn't cross the bridge in those days. It was the Catholic Girls High School down in Narrabundah. Or Griffith. Griffith. It was in Griffith. Yeah.
Okay.
I should say very briefly that if the charismatic and ecumenical tentacles were around you in those days, our word would get out pretty fast.
Oh, it got out. It got out very quickly. Our word spread.
And we found ourselves in high in the Highlands of Scotland.
That's right, yeah. Recreated on a stage in Narrabundah or Braddon or somewhere. Brigadoon was the musical that we were engaged in. I was the male lead, whose name was Freddie Eynsford Hill.
That's the wrong show. You were either Tommy or Jeff, and I was either Tommy or Jeff. And for the life of me,
I must have been Tommy. I think you were Jeff.
Right.
Was Tommy the lead because I'm naturally the lead?
Yeah, it makes me think that because you're quite old, that distance older than me, you were probably paid for your appearance, whereas I was fresh from the Thomaskirche in Leipzig, so I was an unpaid intern on this gig.
Certainly I wasn't paid. I think it was just the joy of performance. It wasn't something I engaged in at my school, at Marist College. I was never part of the musicals that Marist put on. I did the handbills or the flyers, the pamphlets, but I was never on stage. So I think it was just an opportunity to come and do something different.
I want to get onto that because it still strikes me that you're a bit of a handbills man, most happily and naturally, that there is something about your being at your own desk, creating your own craft that really pleases you. Yet in the time since I first met you, you've become what Percy Grainger called the all-round man. You're an artist, comedian, filmmaker, writer, actor, TV host, songwriter, singer, and probably the funniest man I know, although there haven't been terribly many indications of it thus far in our conversation.
No, very true. But I've been scribbling today just before I joined you for this podcast, and it was because I tried to print out something from my printer last night. Printers are always problematic. And I'm going to show it to you. The listeners won't be able to see it, of course, but it's something we can share privately, like a little secret. And it was the head of Donald Trump that I drew in a very sort of scatological but biological sort of way. And because it didn't print properly, half it didn't print, I thought I'd add some of my work to the bottom of it. And I'm just going to show it to you now. So let's see. That is the original image. And then it didn't print. Does that make sense to you? There's Donald.
Yes, yeah.
And then I added that to it.
It's a little hard. It looks like a combination between internal organs, a bit of tongue and tie, and fish heads.
Yes, well, I think the title, I haven't come up with the title yet, but I think the title is going to be something along the lines of the fish saying, "It started off as a wart on my anus."
I so remember my mother saying that to me as a popular Irish saying back in the 80s.
So, yeah, still scribbling, still drawing.
Well, it does seem as though whenever I kind of meet you, and fortunately that's frequently, you do have a book and you're scribbling in it and thinking in it. And we'll get onto that because politics looms large over everything that you do and write and create. But I am kind of interested in how this reluctant stage performer, star even then, I could tell it was in your blood. But even then, this kind of bookish and introverted artist, you know, by the very nature, most interesting artists are introverted, became all those things that I've just listed off with some pride.
Mm. Was that a question?
Yeah, it was. It started with, "I'm interested in how." That usually means that you respond.
Right. It was such a wordy, lengthy I sort of got distracted. I forgot what the original part of the sentence was.
Let me be paragraph. Let me be terse. Let me be terse. How did it happen, Paul?
I was interested in performance, but for many years was just too shy. And Brigadoon was the first thing I engaged in as a performer. And it's where I met you, and I really enjoyed meeting you and the process of performance. And then we went on the next year when you put on My Fair Lady and invited me back again. And you were, at that stage, were the director, the musical director, the choir master. You did you helped with costumes, I believe, designing the costumes. You did the playbill. You did photographs of the cast. I was just amazed at your energy. And, of course, you were a brilliant Colonel Pickering. I was swamped by your immense talent. All I had to be was Higgins prowling around the stage. And after that, I got involved with, as you know, Paul Yuleman and I were doing sort of surreal plays at the time. And that managed to get us on a bill with the early Doug Anthony All-Stars. I was performing in a group called Gigantic Fly, and it was just surreal. Myself and my friend Paul Yuleman were both at art school in Canberra together, and we're enjoying writing these rather bizarre little comic turns. And the All-Stars were the main event. There was a different fellow in the middle of the All-Stars, then a guy called Robert Piper, and Tim and Richard were themselves. And I think in about the second season at Cafe Boom Boom, which was a government-funded comedy venue in Narrabundah, Robert was off doing various activities, and I was invited to come along and be a stand-in while he was completing his studies. And after that, the other two didn't invite Robert back, unfortunately. I got a toe in the door with the All-Stars, and I really enjoyed that process of performance. Withdrawing with art, it's a very, very isolating experience. And you can work on a piece for like 2 years and still people can, you know, shrug it off or ignore it. Whereas that performance and the in-your-face aspect of it, I really enjoyed. And it opened up a whole lot of avenues in me that I wasn't aware of, and ideas in me that I had, but I had never explored. And so I liked the immediacy of performance. I liked the way that people reacted immediately. And I liked the rough honesty of the performance that I was doing. So I enjoyed all those aspects. It was immediately gratifying, whereas drawing, although immediately gratifying for me, was really gratifying for anyone else that I showed my pictures to. So,
but I remember those early gigs with the All-Stars that you were doing, especially down at Cafe Boom Boom, but then even the street busking in Civic, imaginatively named centre of the commercial mercantile area of Canberra. And at that stage, I still would have thought, well, this is just something you're doing. It's easier than a paper run. And, you know, it's something that you do quite naturally. But I remember, and I can't quite remember which year this was, photographing your, I think, your final year exhibition of artwork in the clock tower at the art school. I mean, I would have thought at that stage still that you had thought that you would go on as a visual artist.
I did. I did at that stage. I managed to compact all those ideas into the All-Stars in a way when I was performing with them. And certainly I sort of painted and then designed the costumes and made those. And Betty, my mother, of course, helped with putting the paintings on the back of the jackets. And then I did almost all the graphic work for the group as well, from posters to comic books to, you know, leaflets, flyers, the backdrops for television shows, backdrops for stage shows. So I was very heavily involved in all that. I managed to merge that into the All-Stars and encourage both Richard and Tim to find those aspects in themselves. And I thought with the demise of the All-Stars that I would get back into doing what I started off doing at art school. I would return to that. But Ted Robinson, who was the director producer of the big gig that the All-Stars appeared on and also of Das Kapital, he pursued me for a while after the All-Stars ended and convinced me to get back into performance and not leave comedy or performance behind. But I've always drawn, I've always painted, and I still do that as a regular part of my sort of day or week. Rarely a day goes by where I'm not scribbling or drawing something. But, you know, there are so many other demands on you when you're trying to bring out an hour-long weekly television show or 2 or 3 hours, as various shows got up to with Good News Week and so on. So it's always something now. It became something I did for myself rather than for any sort of commercial sort of enterprise. But I do have so many images and paintings and drawings, you know, over those intervening years. It's just something I've kept sort of pretty private.
I think it's sweet that you somehow imagined that you'd return from, you know, some pretty interesting work in the UK and Edinburgh at the festival, the Fringe Award, etc. Huge offers, touring offers, collaborations and potential collaborations with some very, very interesting artists, all in the swill at that time, that you would leave that and come back to your life as an artist, because it seemed to me that your life had already started off in a very different direction when you moved from Canberra to Melbourne and you know, were gigging down at the Prince Patrick and just the All Stars were really taking off, and that aesthetic that you describe, that, you know, your artwork aesthetic kind of governed everything from then on in what the All Stars were doing. It was amazing how everything came together.
Oh, I love that aspect of it. I liked incorporating all aspects of what I was producing in that group. And I was writing, I mean, most of the material, you know, and writing with Richard all the songs at that point in time as well, apart from, you know, a couple of things that didn't work from the other boys, but nice of them to make an effort. And but I enjoyed that so much. It just seemed to be an outpouring of ideas, and it was the perfect vehicle for it.
And the outpouring of ideas, this is why I love your company, the outpouring of ideas hasn't slowed in any way. Most recently, you produced this very beautiful book that you and I keep kicking around as a potential project for Music Aviva, funnily enough, called Ghost Bear. I'd love you to describe it a little bit, what it is, but also I'd love you to talk about its genesis, which for me is so touching. And so it just in this week when we have a conservative government, you know, turning around and saying, you know what, there may actually be something in all this climate change malarkey, it seems more than ever that this project that you first thought about 7, 8, 9 years ago should have been done then, and is this kind of prescient, you know, canary in the mine.
I almost choked one morning when Josh Frydenberg said climate change, and it wasn't in a mocking tone or with derision, or it wasn't a cue for some journalist to ask him a silly question about fossil fuels. It was, I think it was on ABC Breakfast, and I just couldn't believe it. Of course, it was taking the lead from America and Biden and so on, but it just seemed ridiculous that anyone could get away with that after decrying climate change as fake science for years and mocking it in Parliament, throwing around bits of coal and so on, or chasing each other around the dispatch box saying, oh, well, don't be frightened of it. It's just a piece of coal. To actually have a minister talk about climate change without laughing after it or mentioning that Samoa is going to be underwater in 20 years, it was bizarre. And the turnaround is just ridiculous. I don't think anyone could trust it as being an honest turnaround, but still. This is where we are at this point in time. So, Ghost Bear was a book, illustrated children's book that I wrote and painted. And it's essentially about climate change and the way that we as humans have invaded the habitats of various creatures. And for me, it was also about trying to allow people to have a different view of spirituality that wasn't based on religion. So for a child or a parent reading to their child or a guardian, they might be able to understand a bit more deeply aspects of life and death. So the little bear goes on a journey. It's called Ghost Bear. The ghost bear doesn't realize that it's passed away. So it starts off pretty heavy, I think. But then he finds communion with other creatures that are in the heavens. So it's just a different way of looking, I suppose, at the way we've, you know, all various cultures have looked at death, I suspect, and life after death or whatever that entails. And, yeah, I loved writing it. I loved putting it together. And I particularly loved the time it took me to paint.
And there were two very specific motivations for the story, or inspiration points for the story, one of which, of course, was Knut, the white polar bear in the Berlin Zoo. But the second one is really interesting. You once told me about an article that you had seen that did actually feature a small baby polar bear, white polar bear, on an ice floe separated from its parents. And the outcry that followed that from different political sides. Talk a little bit about that, because it is actually a very poignant story and image.
Yeah, well, the two images that I had in my head, and the two thoughts I had in my head, I'd had them for a while. And sometimes you'll see an image or read something, it'll just keep kicking around. Until you bring it out, until you create some skin for it or some bones for it to move around. And there was I think this goes right back to 2007 or 2005, maybe even earlier. But a scientist on a scientific vessel, a ship, had spotted on an ice floe, and it wasn't a small bear. It was actually a mature polar bear on the ice floe, but it was totally emaciated, starving. It had moved miles and miles beyond its normal, hunting grounds, and it was going to die on that ice floe. And it was such a powerful image. It sort of went around the world very quickly. But then something bizarre happened. A lot of these conservative media personalities started questioning the truth of it, the veracity of it. They claimed that the scientist was inventing this story to push a climate change agenda. And so they managed to change the topic. They moved it away from the obvious noticeable effects of climate change into whether scientists can be believed. And it's something that we're still grappling with at the moment, the way that moment for me was one of the first moments that I was aware of that. I know it's happened before that, but this was like a real, it seemed an absolutely vicious attack on someone that had noticed something in nature and said, this is an indication of the world we're moving towards. And it was ridicule, it was deceit. And that played on my mind for a long time. And the other story, of course, is Knut, the polar bear that was born in captivity at Berlin Zoo, and then he was rejected by his mother. I think he only lived to 4 years of age, had some type of encephalitis, so he drowned in Berlin Zoo. But by that stage, those 4 years, he'd become a global celebrity, very, very cute, beautiful bear in an environment that, he clearly was not meant to be in Berlin. And that was the other aspect of a ghost bear. And I wondered about displaced animals. We believe we have a soul, or many people believe we have a soul. I wondered if the same was true of these creatures and what it would be like for them to be so displaced from the family, the places that they would understand, to be taken to zoos or in other places of the world. And I wondered if, when they died, if there was any way that they could reunite or find their way home again. And so those two images sort of came together to form the story of Ghost Bear and that journey.
Music Aviva would like to say thanks for the support and ongoing partnership of Wesfarmers Arts. Wesfarmers Arts understand the vital contribution that the arts make to the communities in which we live and work, bringing people and art together.
I want to ask you two things, and I don't know in which order to ask them. Okay, I do. I want to ask you about songwriting and how you do it, because we come from very different musical backgrounds, and I've gone down a particular rabbit hole, you've gone down another. But you essentially are the, in music at least, you're the creator, I'm the recreator. And so I'm really interested in your process.
I've always liked singing. I remember from a very young age being, with my mother at Mass, raised a Catholic, and so we'd often be at Mass together. I used to love singing next to her and really, really enjoyed just the feeling that singing out sort of gave to me. So it's always something I've loved, but not something I never really engaged in a way when I was younger. I didn't have really much of a musical education. I think one misshapen, ugly year at Marist College in Canberra, that sort of pushed me well away from the world of music. And when I started with Paul Yeoman, who I mentioned before, and we're doing these little plays, we had an opportunity occasionally to do some singing. I couldn't play an instrument, but I could sing melodies that I had in my head to people. And, you know, if they had a guitar, they could work out what I was singing, or a keyboard or whatever. And so I would write these things, these little melodies in my head, and then I would sing the lyrics to people. And then inevitably fights would break out because I was a dunderhead who didn't know what I was doing. And they knew an E from an F or something. And it was a very, you know, sometimes it could be very problematic. And often, you know, people would say, well, you can't do that. And I thought, well, that's an odd thing to say about something that's creative, that you can't go there. You know, this doesn't work. And I think, well, why not? Why can't it work? Because I can hear it in my head. So if I can hear it in my head, then let's all try and get on that page, and let's not be owned by conventional rules. But that didn't always work. And over the years, I steadfastly refused to learn an instrument just because I thought I was too old to learn an instrument. You know, that's something that people had started when they were young. And
you were too old, by the way.
Oh, well, yeah, I was.
It's not just something people are saying. Oh, I heard him say.
So I really felt I was behind the eight ball. And here I was on TV shows and with the All-Stars singing, and I didn't know what I was doing. I just loved singing, and I had a nice voice, and I would get intoxicated by my own voice. So I'd be quite happy just singing on the back of a bus or something, as much as actually being on stage. And I kept writing these songs. So I, you know, during the All-Stars, I wrote most of those songs with Richard most of the time, once or twice with Tim. And then after the All-Stars, when I started work on Good News Week, we'd do various songs all the time. And I did a lot of original songs on those Good News Week shows, and always with these extraordinary musicians. And I really felt like a bit of an idiot, because I didn't have the language of music, you know, and saying, I want this to sound like heavy air, or, you know, any other euphemisms I could use to try and describe what I would like became, you know, was often problematic. But these people often would help me, and they knew what they were doing. I didn't know what I was doing, but eventually these combination of talents would produce some very beautiful songs. And over the years, I'm quite proud of that output. Yeah, I feel in a good place now. When I was about 43, maybe 44, my old friend Paul Livingston, who used to come over to my place, and he would play guitar while I sang in these stupid songs. We'd have a drink, and that's how we'd spend some days. I'd just come up with this little melody, and he'd go, oh, well, I'll play guitar. But he got a bit bored by that after a while and just said, you should learn how to play guitar yourself. And I said, I'm too old. I was old when I was, you know, 20, and now look at me, this disheveled horror show of a human being.
Yet with a very clear skin.
Yeah. You old flirt, you. And so Livo took me to a music store up in Bondi Junction at the time and just bought me a guitar, just a $60 classical guitar. He had no money at the time. And it really is, it remains as one of the most lovely things anyone's done for me. And even though now, after years of just fiddling with this thing, I can't really play a song, but what I can do is put, you know, one of four or five chords on the guitar to the melody I'm singing. And that was like a revelation. And since then, I've written, I don't know, dozens and dozens, probably in the realm of hundreds of little songs. And they all, I'm sure, to someone with a musical ear, they all sound the same, and they're all in the same area and so on. But I just find it like a little puzzle that I love solving to try and find my way through.
You're obviously unused to any form of media at all, but it would help the pacing of this podcast if you could simply answer my question, which was, how do you do it? And I'm going to answer it a bit, because I've actually watched you do this, and you're being very disingenuous about the creative process, because it's very clear in your head, the shape, the harmonic implications of anything that you've written, and people that have collaborated with you are merely dressing up the idea. You're very kind of steadfast on what you want. So you can pull this bumbling, oh, I don't know what I'm doing routine all you like.
I learned it from you, Kildare. I learned it from your pickering.
But the fact remains that the song always lands pretty close to where it is in your head when you set off on this adventure, which leads to me a good 20 minutes ago, I said I didn't know which question to ask first. And I'm glad I asked that one first, because it does lead into the concept of collaboration. And in chamber music, and ensemble music, collaboration is everything. And it's my job to kind of, you know, analyze an ensemble and say, oh, that person is fantastic in this repertory, or that's the weak link, or whatever. And so I wonder how you've viewed your successful and less successful collaborations, and yet you still keep coming back for more. So I wonder if you could talk a little about collaboration and as an art form.
Oh, I do love collaboration. And I think most of my life has been a collaborative process, whether it's with Tim and Richard, or whether it's on Good News Week and working with Ted Robinson, who was the director and producer of that series, or Mikey and Julie McCrossan. There have always been a number of people around me that I've worked very closely with, particularly on the look or structure of shows or on stage, and having that you know, ability to be able to work with a number of people, Steve Abbott, Paul Livingston, you know, in the world of comedy. And then, of course, in my short films with Justine Kerrigan and other people. I find it very, very interesting. So I've always have an idea that is, you know, as hard as stone that I want to express and want to get it out of my body, basically. But I've always enjoyed working with others to make that happen. And most recently, I've been working with Glenn Morehouse, who's a, you know, multi-instrumentalist, music record producer, and just a lovely man. And I'm really, you know, out of many collaborations, I'm really enjoying this one at this point in my life. It's just very open and very easy. You know, there's not a lot of tussle or ego involved in it, and we just, in both of us, just enjoy making stuff for the sake of making stuff. And that's really one of the beautiful aspects about it, just being able to say, well, you know, this is a little idea I have, and here it is. And for someone to give it the necessary structure it needs, or to be able to throw in an idea, I really love that, when someone adds to what is already there, the bare bones of something, and manages to clad it. That brings me great joy.
Well, all of this leads us to, in conclusion, I suppose, where perhaps I should have started, and where I know it does start with you in your work, and its variance on the word of politics and what that means. But there's always been a kind of darkness in your work. I'd love you to talk a little bit about that if you want to and can. But I know you as an immensely funny and happy person, and I just wonder if there have been relatively carefree periods in your life politically, which is then mirrored in your work.
I'm finding the political situation now, and it could be my age, just perilous, I think. There just seems to be, at this point in time, this incredible rise of, you know, right-wing agendered politics that seems to be swamping the globe. And it's extraordinarily distressing. I remember when Pauline Hanson first appeared, and I thought, well, this is okay. This woman that, to me, seemed incredibly racist, but also combined with a, you know, very, very mediocre intelligence that was propelling this blinkered arrogance and privilege. And I thought, well, when people were following her and putting their hands up, I was saying, well, we can now see who the people are in this society that are rednecks and have the same sort of politics. And I didn't think that was a particularly bad thing at the time, even though it was Pauline Hanson was, you know, puppet for John Howard. And now I really don't know how I feel. I mean, she's now, what, past 20-something years that she's been on the Australian political scene. She had regular guest spots on Channel 7 in the morning, the breakfast show, like she was a go-to politician to talk to. But really, the sense that you get from someone like that is just chaos and mayhem. So why do these media outlets have her on? Why do they support her? And it does make you wonder at the type of world that we may have had in Australia if the last 20 years weren't marred by the presence of Pauline Hanson turning up to Parliament in a burqa, or saying hideous things about Muslims or immigration in general. And that world that she sort of brought to the fore of Australian politics over 20 years ago is now a world that seems to be flourishing in the minds of a lot of people. And certainly with COVID, and once again with the deterioration of trust in science and fact, which I just find phenomenal, because of maybe the spread of social media or because people no longer trust governments or for whatever reasons, it just seems we are on the precipice of something absolutely sort of bizarre that over the course of my life I've never experienced. And I'm going right back to Thatcher days as well in Britain, which were pretty frightening in themselves, and the way that the workers, you know, the people that basically build a nation, were treated in Britain. So, yeah, I think we are in quite concerning times now, and they make those Ronald Reagan years and those Thatcher years almost seem idyllic by comparison. You know, when you have an insurrection in the United States on January the 6th, and yet, you know, almost an entire year away from that moment now, we're still yet to see any of the main culprits that the world is aware were the culprits being brought to justice.
My old friend, let's pick up Ghost Bear and continue a conversation that I've cherished for 40 years now. It seems incredible, but there it is. Paul McDermott, lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you, Paulie. Always good.
Thank you for listening. You can find show notes for the episode on our website, musicaviva.com.au/podcast. To learn more about our work and upcoming concerts, find us on Facebook by searching Music Aviva Australia and on Instagram and Twitter with the handle @musicavivaau. Thanks again and see you next time.